You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today comes mostly from Genesis 1, the priestly author's formal description of the systematic creation of particular environments to sustain particular animals and plants. And just for good measure, we've thrown in one verse from the much older creation story of Genesis 2, where God sets Ha'adam, the creature made of earth, to tending the Adama, the earth itself. Together, these passages are pretty clear in setting out a job description for humans: grow communities and care for the earth. That's it. We are given the responsibility of stewards, caring for the earth and one another. And this image of there being a deep relationship between the divine, humans, and the earth is embedded not just in these opening stories, but throughout the whole Bible. Across generations of authors, the message remains consistent. Human beings need to not only be aware of, but intentionally nurture the profound connection between nature, the divine, and humanity.
Our words of wisdom are from Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 through 31, and chapter 2, verse 15.
So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, God created them. Male and female, God created them. God blessed them, and God said to them,
"Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, over everything, every living thing that moves upon the earth."
God said,
"See, I have given you every plant-yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food."
And it was so. God saw everything that God had made, and indeed it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. The Lord God took the earth creature and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
One day, a woman arrived home from work and discovered she didn't have everything she thought she had to get dinner started. So she called her husband and asked him to stop by the store on his way home to pick up some particular vegetables, making sure he understood that she wanted them to be organic. Once the husband arrived at the store, he began to search for the organic section, to no avail. Finally, he asked an employee of the store where the organic vegetables were. As it turned out, it was the employee's first day, and he just stared at the man, clueless. Impatient, the husband said, "Look, these vegetables are for my wife. I need to know if they've been sprayed with poisonous chemicals or not." To which the employee, trying to be helpful, replied, "No, sir, you'll have to put poisonous chemicals on them yourself." Look, we all have different levels of awareness of where our food comes from and what effect our choices have on the wider world. Our culture's addiction to a particular style of French fry has motivated producers to grow just one particular species of potato, creating a dangerous monoculture that is susceptible to genetic fragility and disease. Our wild passion for guacamole and avocado toast has attracted the attention of Mexico's drug cartels, some of whom have taken over virtually all avocado production and turned states like Michoacan into some of the most violent places in the world, all over control of the avocado crop. And let's not even talk about what our coffee habit, my coffee habit, has done to cultures around the world. But none of this is new. In his book, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis, Amitav Ghosh details the history of nutmeg, a spice most of us take for granted today, but at one time drove Dutch colonizers into such frenzy of exploitation that they didn't give a second thought to the genocide of not only whole peoples, but of nature itself. In the early 1600s, the Dutch East India Company, abbreviated VOC, was the biggest economic juggernaut on the planet. To give you an idea of just how big, here's a graphic, adjusted for inflation, of the value of the VOC compared to all these modern companies combined. Staggering. Let's just say they could do whatever they wanted. And who was going to stop them? At one point, the VOC cornered the market on nutmeg, grown almost exclusively on 10 tiny specks in what is now Indonesia, but were then known as the Banda Islands. The VOC's ruthless pursuit of profit drove these overtly Christian Dutch to commit unspeakable atrocities that not only included genocide of the indigenous Bandanese people, but when the price of spices fell, the VOC responded with cold, calculated countermeasures. They systematically eradicated every nutmeg tree on any other island other than the ones that they controlled, destroying whole ecosystems in the process. Subsequently, they were able to limit the supply of nutmeg on the global market and drive prices and profits back up. Our history as human beings has always seemed to entangle us with the voracious consumption of various earthly materials, be they spices, tea, sugarcane, opium, fossil fuels, rare earth elements for lithium-ion batteries, or expendable human beings. The one thing they all have in common is their being the latest and greatest must-have resource, along with an attitude that believes nature exists for one purpose only, as a resource for humans to use for our own ends, here and now. Amitav Ghosh warns that the potential for unrestrainable excess that seems to lie hidden at the heart of this world-as-resource vision leads not just to genocide, but an even greater violence, an impulse that he calls omnicide, the desire to destroy everything. Because guess what? If I can't have it, neither can you. And where does this selfish, omnicidal impulse spring from? In part, it comes from our Genesis passage for today, and a misinterpretation of the idea of dominion, yet another biblical passage warped over the years by those who count on most people never reading their Bible. First off, the passage does not say what most people think it says. It does not say we have dominion over the earth. What the passage does say is that we have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. But even this is not what most people think it is. Our normal definition of having dominion over another is to rule over them. But herein we have a problem. The word we translate as have dominion in English is the Hebrew verb rada, which is related to other words which have the meanings of descend, go down, wander and spread, which is hard to capture in English. It literally means going down, walking among as an equal. What? What about being in charge? Well, that kind of dominion is reflected in the perfectly good Hebrew verb malak, which is not used here. So, the intentional use of the Hebrew verb rada seems to be an on-purpose vision of humanity walking among and having a relationship of equality with all of creation. Furthermore, according to the text, whatever claim we think we have, dominion is clearly only over the fish, birds, and some farm animals. And then, not even for food. God clearly says, "See, I have given you every plant-yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food, but not the animals." According to Genesis, we were created to be vegetarians and to walk among the animals as equals. This, by the way, is a directive that changes only after Noah gets off the ark and God gives humans permission to eat meat, but that's another sermon. However you slice it, if you take the text seriously, the old "we have dominion" argument just doesn't cut it. But what about that word "subdue"? We're supposed to subdue the earth. Again, our English translation doesn't convey the subtlety of the Hebrew. The word we translate as subdue is kavash, and carries with it the sense of bringing order to something or controlling something. Remember, the whole point of Genesis 1 is showing creation in chaos. The earth was complete chaos, and darkness was over the face of the deep. Then God systematically brings order to chaos, putting the kibosh on chaos, as it were. Because kibosh is our English word that comes from the Hebrew kavash, to subdue. And the biblical idea that sums up all of this kavashing and radahing is the notion of stewardship. And like a wine steward on a ship, or a shop steward, the biblical idea of stewardship orbits around the idea of wisely managing resources, be it money or the environment. And that all goes back to the Greek origins of English words we use all the time. In Greek, oikos means household or family, and it's where we get our English prefix eco. So add nomos, which means rule or law, to oikos, and we get the word economy, economy. Add logos, reason or deep knowledge, to oikos, and we get ecology, ecology, deep knowledge of our oikos, of our environment. And yet, with what this week may be one of the earlier arrivals of 100-degree weather here in Phoenix, it's becoming clear, even to climate change skeptics, that something is definitely going on. And even if you think, well, I'm going to be fine, I have the resources to flex with whatever changes are coming, not everyone does. More than 5 million mostly poor children die each year from diseases related to our decaying environment. Asthma, dysentery, cholera, malaria, and more. And that's not just in developing nations. That's right here in the U.S. too. So what do? Lots of us recycle and try to use less water. Some of us have invested in solar energy or hybrid or electric vehicles. But real and lasting change in the final analysis is going to take action on a national and global scale. So our actions as voters become a direct reflection of our understanding of what being a steward means. It doesn't get talked about nearly enough, but between 2017 and 2020, the previous administration rolled back or completely dismantled over 100 previously established climate policies and rules governing clean air, water, wildlife, and toxic chemicals, including making it easier for companies to blatantly pollute fragile ecosystems and then shield them from any accountability. I, for one, am unable to discern how this, in any way, makes us good stewards, or makes America great again, for that matter. Meanwhile, I don't think the current administration gets enough credit for having spearheaded dozens of environmental and climate initiatives that have targeted super polluters, scaled up the use of renewable energy, cut emissions, and tried to alter our trajectory as a country to be more in line with preserving the planet's resources and curbing environmental injustice. I think when Jesus said, "Inasmuch as you've done this to the least of these, you've done it unto me," he would have wanted us to pay attention to the fact that communities of color in the U.S. are more likely than white neighborhoods to be near sites where toxic waste, unsafe air, and lead in the water goes unchecked. It finally comes down to making a conscious decision. Are we going to be advocates for subduing and having dominion, Dutch East India style or Jesus style? Pundit Ann Coulter, always reliable for a steady stream of abhorrent comments, is so outrageous on her answer to this question, I hesitate to even bring attention to it. But she declared, "God gave us the earth. We have dominion over the plants, the animals, the trees. God said, 'Earth is yours. Take it. Sexually assault it. It's yours.'" And she used a different word than sexually assault. This kind of attitude sees dominion not as rada, as stewards, but as permission to exhaust creation's resources with extreme prejudice for our own purposes, with creation serving as a mere backdrop for the drama of human arrogance. Thankfully, more and more people are realizing that, as we become more and more people, that foundational systems of this fragile planet, our eco, our household, are being threatened. And as stewards, we aren't fulfilling our job description if we don't do something about it. Since 1970, every spring, churches and other groups celebrate Earth Day, an effort to remind ourselves of our interconnectedness with our environment. And as theologian John Cobb suggests, it's a nice gesture, but we've got enough catching up to do that we probably need more than just a day of reminding. What we consume matters. How we treat others matters. How we vote matters. And the sooner we can get it through our heads that we as humanity are not the sole purpose of creation, the better. We're just one part of a much bigger project. Throughout the Bible, we're reminded of our interconnectedness, not separateness from or superiority over the earth. Even though we're only here for a short time, we need to be constantly reminded that our actions have profound consequences. So if your mother didn't teach you this already, maybe there's still time to take this admonition to heart. Act like you live here. People who are paying attention know that there is an interconnectedness of all that is, a oneness with the divine, with creation, and with each other. And the more we can foster our awareness of that interconnectedness, that interdependence, the more effective stewards we'll be in knowing and caring for our oikos. Remember, our tradition teaches that the earth actually belongs to God, and we're just here as caretakers, period. And I don't know about you, but my mama taught me, when visiting somewhere, to always leave the place in better shape than when you arrived. Seems pretty simple, doesn't it? Happy Earth Day.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.